It's Mom Zone. Breaking news, the Fremont family declares where they're going for back to school.
The Fremonts are going with Academy.
Mrs. Fremont, why Academy over another store?
When my kids say they'll never use math in the real world, I just show them how low my Academy receipt is.
Do you have any other thoughts?
Look, back to school is a numbers game, and numbers don't lie.
Nobody starts your season with better brands and lower prices than Academy. Academy Sports and Outdoors. For all, for less. Price match guarantee details at academy.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Back Nine Report. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres, and every week I'm alongside my co-host Fred Alveda. Fred, hi, how are you today?
Fantastic, Carlos. We're coming off the PGA Championship last week. We're going to talk some about that tonight. We've got a Solheim Cup this week, so that's big. But, you know, Quail Hollow played a bit more difficult than we even expected when we talked about it last week. We thought we were watching a PGA Championship, but a U.S. Open broke out, for goodness sake. PGA's master golf setup artist, Kerry Haig, must have taken some notes from Mike Davis's handbook when setting up the U.S. Open venue. Hey, Carlos, this week in golf, Justin Thomas joins his buddy Jordan Spieth as a major winner. With the new renovations to Quail Hollow, Tom Fazio created a beast. Plus, as I mentioned, it's Solheim Cup week. Woohoo! Let's talk some golf. Let's go, Carlos.
It's big-time golf. I mean, last week we had a ton of things to talk about, but we're going to talk about the PGA Championship, and we're going to talk about the Solheim Cup. Man, are we going to have time to cover all that? You don't want to miss it. We have everything you need to know about the Solheim Cup, both teams, the captains, the golf course, everything there is to know about the Solheim Cup. We have it for you. But first of all, we're going to start, as usual, with the weekend backman. Every week, Fred and I recap every tournament that has happened on the major tours, but there was nothing more major than a proper major. The PGA Championship, which was the last major on the schedule on the PGA Tour. And like you said, Justin Thomas, wow, what a performance there at that final round. I mean, I guess that when that ball that hanging on the lip by 7 seconds dropped in, there was nothing that was going to stop him from winning that tournament. So tell us everything about Justin Thomas' great win there at the PGA Championship.
Well, you know, Carlos, we see Quail Hollow every year for the tournament that they hold there and the Wells Fargo. And we've seen Rory win there. We've seen Ricky went there. You know, we see it every year, and it was a difficult golf course. But holy moly, Tom Fazio came in right after the tournament ended last year, and he created. They really made it. They really toughened it up. It was really difficult. But when Justin Thomas struck that 212-yard 7-iron to 15 feet at number 17 on Sunday, I texted you and said that'll do it. And then he calmly drained the putt, took a two-shot lead to the final hole with only Kisner behind him that needed to birdie out to tie. Thomas joins his buddy Jordan Spieth as a major winner on the PGA Tour. Have you seen the picture going on Facebook of Spieth and Thomas as kids sitting under a scoreboard, and Thomas has that hamburger in his mouth? That is priceless. It must be about 10, 11, 12 years old, something like that. That's good stuff. Kind of a surprise, Francisco Molinari used a final round 67 to grab a piece of the runner-up check with Patrick Reed and also the holder of the title of career Grand Slam runner-ups, Louis Oosthuizen. You know, this would be a dubious honor at best if Oosthuizen didn't already earn a claret jug at St. Andrews and the Open Championship. So that's kind of cool that he's they set a runner-up in all four majors. It looked for a while, and you're going to talk about this, I know, because you just can't let this go, but it looked for a while like this would be Hideki's second consecutive victory and first major, but he faltered and fell back. Three short putts missed at the beginning of his round on Sunday seemed to set the tone, plus three bogeys on the back nine with a final nail in the coffin. Carlos, you want to say anything about Hideki while we're here, or you want to wait till later?
I'll wait. Just go ahead, and I'll recap about that afterwards. No problem.
Ricky Fowler failed once again to win a major, but gets another top five. He slipped in a tie for fifth with Hideki when Kisner made double bogey at the 72nd hole. Speaking of Kisner, he had the local knowledge on his side. Many of his family belonged to Quail Hollow, and he played great all week, but just didn't have quite enough in his tank for the final round on Sunday. We talked last week that the PGA would be won by a long hitter, and Kisner is definitely not that. Did you see he was consistently 30 to 50 yards behind Hideki and Jason Day, but his putting was fantastic, and his chipping was well above average, as always. The Canadian, Graham Gillette, hopefully has completely cured his shanks and finished tied with Kisner for 7th. Matt Kuchar, there's that guy. Tied for 9th, just another ho-hum top 10 in a major, along with Jason Day, England's Jordan Smith, and Chris Stroud. Day was in contention on the 54th hole on Saturday, but an ugly 8, ugly, ugly 8 on the par 4 18th blew his chance of winning. I mean, that looked like you and me, Carlos, out there hacking around. I don't know what he was thinking, but that was a complete mental breakdown.
Did you see the picture of him behind everybody? Where in the world is Jason Day?
yes, I know. After his Saturday 77, he came back with a 7 to finish at T9. As I mentioned, it was a great showing for Chris Stroud, winner last week in Reno, to be the last man into the PGA Championship. That should set him up for the next couple of years. Really, really good deal. Really good deal for Chris Stroud. The betting favorites going into the week, Rory McIlroy finished T22, and Jordan Spieth posted T28. Neither was a factor at the PGA Championship. Rory's making sounds like he may take a substantial portion of the rest of the year off. Maybe he likes this married life thing and wants to spend more time with his toys and the new bride. Seriously, he is still struggling with his injuries and may need more time away to completely heal. He's also struggling with who is going to be his permanent caddy. Harry Diamond is evidently just a part-timer on the bag. Did you see Ian Poulter had another good week and Steve Stricker made another cut in a major? This guy just keeps chugging along. Telecast. Well, bad news, I'm afraid, from television. With Sunday's PGA Championship overnight rating of 3.6, we have a matching average for the final round of the U.S. Open, the Open, and the PGA. And that's all bad. Those are not good numbers. Why? Well, the brutal Saturday viewing and the lack of megastar power on the leaderboard did not make Sunday appointment viewing. Jason Day kind of – I think a lot of people turned off after he screwed up. And I know – I'm telling you, I'm watching Saturday – and it was a labor for me to watch Saturday. You know, all of those bogeys and all of the problems they were having. The golf course was too hard. I just didn't enjoy it. So the casual gal fan, I know, probably did not tune in on Sunday after Saturday's telecast. The long telecast, I mean, it was slow play. It took 6 hours for Saturday to play the round, for goodness sake. And that was because the course was so difficult. And then there was the commercial breaks. It seemed like they'd do 2 shots, go to commercial break, come back 2 or 3 shots. Even Jim Nance complained about too many ads during a timeout. They caught him on tape. Plus, I mean, there's live streaming everywhere. You could find it. You know, I mean, there was even an app on my Roku TV that I could download to watch it live on that. Let alone PGA.com and all the other places you could see it. So it's easy to watch. You just don't have to watch on TV. So, like I say, I think the problem for the television really came on Saturday when viewers became bored with the difficult conditions and the poor play of the leaders. Plus, the slow play was an issue as well. So, Carlos, that's kind of what I had from PGA Championship. So I'll leave the rest of the wrap up to you.
Yes, I mean, congratulations to Justin. I mean, that was a final round that was really interesting. I mean, you got Francesco Molinari, Patrick Reed, Louis Oosthuizen. I mean, Ricky Fowler posted a very low 67 early, so he was in contention. But he needed some help from the guys ahead. Justin really was solid that 68. It was his day. I mean, it was incredibly played. Those three birdies in the back nine, just that bogey there on 18 really didn't matter at the end of the tournament. So really he had done the job before that. Patrick Reed, another very good showing for me. I saw that most of these, most of the players, if you see, they had a round that wasn't that good. But for Francesco, he had two amazing. Francesco Molinari had an amazing Friday with a 64 and a great 67 there on Sunday. So if he wouldn't have shot those 73 and 74, who knows what could have happened with Francesco. He was leading at one point. Louis Eisen, like you say, he's always seems to play great in the majors and comes out empty at the end. But he did had a 70 there. So he wasn't that big. It was just a one under for him, but he takes
the biggest disappointment of all.
Well, I'm not disappointed. I'm sad that he didn't win, really, because I feel for him. He started the day. There you see him, he's just one back. When the tournament was over, the third round, on Saturday night, I go to bed and I say, this is Hideki's tournament. He won it. That's it. It's over. He's the only big-time player there that was close at the time to Kevin Kisner, who was playing solid. And I said, hey, Hideki style there at the end, he's going to be bombing those tee shots. He's going to be passing everybody in that final round. Then he gets that five in the second to fall two behind, and I go like, wow. But then he recovers with those back-to-back in six and seven, the birdies, and he leads. He's leading with nine holes to play there at the PGA Championship at Quail Hollow. And then, all of a sudden, what happened? I mean, he got the birdie on 10, but then those three consecutive bogeys on the back nine, 11, 12, and 13, and he was just hitting the ball long in those approaches, very uncharacteristically for him. I just think the pressure got to him. He said, like, I'm leading. I just need seven more holes. He needed just 11 through 18 to go. He should have just par his way out. He would have won it. But those three just took him out. He was gallant to come back and get back-to-back birdies in 14 and 15. He's just one behind right there after 15, but then a bogey in 16, that short par, that lip off the left edge of the cup. I mean, I almost dropped. He dropped him two strokes behind. I dropped. He was in disbelief. When he missed that, I almost dropped to the floor. I was like, what? No way you can miss that. I mean, no. That did it right there. There was nothing. He was just in two strokes behind, and then the bogey in 18 did him. But I mean, I fell for him because he really wanted it. He had the pressure of all Japan behind him. This guy's in, like, first Rio Ishikawa. All that, he has this massive entourage of reporters from Japan behind him. He was having coverage all the way in Japan. I mean, the expectations for him to become the first Japanese player to ever win a major championship.
It is a contingent of Japanese media too when Hideki's playing
it's,
like
it's
this.
A little.
I mean, we're talking 30, 40 guys. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Who they bring? Yeah,
I mean, I remember when Rio was the guy, and I remember him playing in the Puerto Rico Open, and he wasn't even a star in the PGA Tour, and he would have these 20, 25 people after he finished. They would set up a tent there for him just to talk to the Japanese media. So imagine Hideki now, who is really big time compared to what Rio was. But I mean, also I want to talk about something that he announced yesterday. And I want to tie it up, and after this I'll be done with my report here. But as you know, he was really, really hot at the beginning of the wraparound season. I mean, it looked like he was skyrocketing to number one. But then I know that he changed his putting stroke, which I have been critical about all the time, and now I am thankful that he did went back. But there is something that might have been also in the back of his mind, and I don't know why it came just all of a sudden or why he had it hidden until yesterday, and it was that he has been married since January and that he's now a father. News which caught the Japanese media and fans by surprise. It's like, what? Edward, and you're that, and you didn't say a word? I mean, this through numerous Japanese reporters that follow Matsuyama every second of the day that he spends on the golf.
How do you hide something like that? How do you hide that, even in Japan? How do you hide
your and your fatherhood on the wraps for months? he said in a statement that his child, which is a girl, was born just in July, but did not reveal the details of the identity of his wife in that announcement. I mean, it came just news. It became news only hours after he falls short in his quest to become the first Japanese man to ever win a major championship. And I don't know if this has been something that he wanted to take off of his chest or something, if it was because it was just shortly after he finished. So I don't know if now he's like, okay, I'm liberated, I got this off, but I can understand at some point as well. I mean, like we have just said, he's being covered every single day when he's on a golf course by an army of media there from Japan. So I wonder if he just wants to keep that life of himself private and not get into it. But at some point it was going to come out. The girl's a month old, so he's not going to be able to hide it for so much longer. So, I mean, congratulations to him. I feel for him that he missed. But I think this might have had something to do with this up and down that we were talking about him. I know that I have always said that it was due to his change in the putting stroke, but I don't know if this had anything to do with his up and down, because it was so strange. He was just skyrocketing towards the top, and then all of a sudden he started, you know, getting off, of course. But hopefully now he can look forward to a great FedEx Cup, and I look forward for him going into the Masters and winning his first major championship next year, Fred.
Yeah, you know, we don't know what these guys are dealing with in their home life or away from the golf course. And, you know, Carlos, golf is so mental, especially at their level. If you're not totally focused, if you're worried about something, your mind is thinking about something else, it affects your play for sure. So, yeah, that could very well have affected him starting at the beginning of the year. So, but, yeah, maybe it's good he's got it off his chest now. And, you know, he looks like a guy who could be a number one, who could be a contender with Rory and with Jordan at majors. I mean, the record shows. He's been involved in majors now for about 5 years and performed very well. So, you know, the Masters, I see him winning at the Masters. I mean, that Masters is made for him. I see him, I don't know about a U.S. Open or a British, but the PGA and the Masters, I see him winning those. He probably could win more than one. So if he can win a Firestone, if you win a Firestone, you can win anywhere, I'm telling you. So, maybe this will be good for him, Carlos.
Hopefully. We'll see. But the other guy that we have to talk about maybe before we move on to the next to the Web.com tour, Rory McIlroy. I don't know what's going on with him. He played decent. I mean, it wasn't like oh, forgot. I'm sorry. I have here my notes. I have to mention Jordan Spieth. I mean, I had said that was one of my dark horses. I think this guy's going to be big time. Jordan Spieth, he has the tempo. If he wouldn't have to shot that 75 on Friday, but yeah, he then after that was very good, and he looks the part. He was calm, cool, yeah, collected the other three rounds. He's a star in the making. Look out for Jordan Spieth. He's a good player, and he's just on the rise. He's learning. This was, to me, I mentioned this was going to be like an experiment for him. He's been progressively winning at every single level that he's been. This is just his next level right now. So we'll see more of Jordan Spieth. I surely want to see him more now here on this side of the pond, maybe next year. But talking about Rory, his ribs, he says now that he doesn't know when we're going to see him, that it could be next year. It could be in a couple of weeks. It really depends. I don't know what he is. He doesn't make up his mind. He said that he can go out there and play decent, shoot decent scores. But the problem is when he comes off the course, that he feels that that left rhomboid is going into spasms, and he really doesn't allow him to sleep well. His left arm is going numb, so he doesn't know what to do with it. So thankfully, he's going to have this next week off, and he's going to assess what he needs to do to go forward. But he could play in the FedEx Cup playoffs. He could even lose the first one, and he's still going to be there. But it's definitely something that, you know, ribs are is something that you cannot put a cast or anything in it. That's rest that really takes a while for it to get fixed. So I don't know, Fred, what's going to happen with Rory. He also has this change of caddy. He's still looking for a fixed one. So I don't know what your thoughts are about Rory before we close here.
Well, I really doubt that I really think he's going to play in the FedEx Cup. I mean, he'd have to really be hurting not to play in the FedEx Cup. There's just too much money on the table. Of course, he's got two contracts worth $250 million each. So, he's not hurting for money. I understand that. But for him to walk away from the FedEx Cup, he'd almost have to be on his deathbed, I would think. I could see him not playing in the race to Dubai on the European Tour. I could see him X-ing that because that doesn't have near the prestige. But he doesn't have anything really big coming up after the FedEx Cup because there's no Ryder Cup for him this year. So I could see him taking the rest of the year off after that. But I really doubt it. I would be surprised if he didn't play in the FedEx, at least two or three events of the FedEx Cup. So we'll see. But, yeah, it's, Carlos, we've talked about this before. I mean, it's tough to play when you're injured. And if you can't sleep and you can't rest and things are bothering you, it's on your mind, you can't focus. And that's exactly what we're seeing from Rory. Something is distracting because he has one or two bad holes, like in one round. One round, he'll shoot a 74 or something. And it just blows him out of the week. Rory, you can tell exactly what he's thinking pretty much all the time. And he's hitting the driver well. He's really, and usually when Rory's hitting the driver well, he's scoring well. And it's just not quite happening for him right now. So I really think the injury is bothering him, and he probably does need to take time off. But I'll be surprised if he doesn't play in the FedEx Cup.
Yeah, I think that he will skip maybe the Northern Trust and come back for the Dell Technologies. I think he takes 2 weeks off and then comes back. He doesn't need the Northern Trust, and if he can rest. I mean, he's the defending champion of the Dell Technologies, so that could be the way to go. But we don't know. Hopefully he gets better, and we can see him defend his FedEx Cup title. So that would be awesome to see. Hey, there was another tournament played, but that was in the Web.com Tour. That was the Price Cutter Charity Championship. And the hope Sunday there was to crown a champion by sundown. But in order to do that, golfers would have to finish their third and fourth rounds in one day. The final day of the 2017 Charity Championship started bright and early for the pros, setting up a marathon day of golf. Saturday night's leader, Conrad Schindler, had a bad Sunday morning when the fourth round teed off in the afternoon. 16 golfers had passed him. One of those golfers was Ben Silverman. He shot his second straight 63 to soar into a lead at 20 under. Chesson Hadley made a move at the turn. He birdied 8, then 11 to move to 22 under par. Oklahoma State grad Taylor Gooch, he joined him at 22 under with his birdie on 11 that jump-started this round. Silverman was up to the challenge. He matched with birdies on 10 and 12, and both were at 23 under par, but the 29-year-old Canadian had no idea that was that way. He said, "I don't know. I saw a 23 under par earlier, but I didn't know what was going on." So on 16, Silverman rolled in and hit this 12-foot birdie putt to move into sole possession of first place at 24 under. Gooch, hey, he had one last gasp. A birdie on 18 moved him into a tie for first at 24 under, but that left Silverman needing a birdie on 18. He shot his eagle close, and he tapped in for his first win in the Web.com Tour. He carded rounds of 70, 63, 63, and 65 to total 25 under for the week in Missouri. You know, the Web.com Tour's Price Cutter Charity Championship in Springfield, Missouri, sure likes its Canadian champions. Following in Mackenzie Hughes' footsteps last year, the native from Thornhill, Ontario, Ben Silverman, he captured his first tournament here also. Now with that $121,500 first check placed, first place check, Silverman is moving up to 16 on the tour's money list and guaranteed himself a PGA Tour card for the next season. He lives in Florida, by the way, and works with PGA of Canada instructor Liam Mucklow and became a father on July 18. He had not teed up during the tournament for a month, taking time to be with his wife and newborn. But in his last appearance before that in Utah, he had tied for fifth, where he's definitely having some momentum going into the finals. He's an accomplished hockey player that growing up, he went to school in Florida. He stayed there to dominate the mini tour circuit rather than try to play on the old Canadian tour back home. Then he returned to Canada once the PGA Tour took over that domestic tour and earned his Web.com Tour card at Q School in 2015. Fred now is on to the big leagues next year for Silverman.
Yeah, that's coming right up the ladder, isn't it? He started at the bottom, the mini tours, and just worked his way right up. So that's exactly how they set that up to work, and it's doing well. Hey, Carlos, the U.S. Women's Amateur was held last week. 21-year-old University of Texas senior Sophia Schubert defeated Stanford University standout Albane Valenzuela, who's 19, from Switzerland. Valenzuela, you wouldn't think of Switzerland. 6-5 in Sunday's 36-hole U.S. Women's Amateur Final match at the San Diego Country Club. Coming into the week, Schubert's name was not on the tip of anyone's tongue, even though she was number 66 in the Women's Amateur Golf ranking. Her only previous USGA experience was a round of 64 defeat in the 2011 U.S. Girls Junior. Since she transferred to Texas from Auburn, and her game has steadily improved. She was co-runner-up in the 2016 Big 12 Championship. And Carlos, as always, there is an Ohio connection here with Ms. Schubert. You know I wouldn't miss this. She won the Lady Buckeye Invitational earlier this year. So I'm going to tell you, Carlos, I learned how to play on Scarlet at Ohio State. That's where I really started playing seriously. And I'm telling you, if you can win in Ohio on the Scarlet course, you can win anywhere. She's had a very strong year with 7 top 10 finishes, and earlier this summer she advanced to the semifinals of the Women's Western Amateur. So the win should also earn Schubert a spot on the U.S. Curtis Cup team next year. That's all I have, Carlos, from the last weekend's action.
Yeah, before I close the weekend back, I just want to tell you about Albane Valenzuela. You know, there's only 2 Valenzuelas that I've heard in the sports world. That's Patrick Valenzuela, the Hall of Fame jockey, and Fernando Valenzuela, who's from Mexico.
Fernando.
Right? Patrick also is of Mexican descent and ascent.
Yeah.
And Valenzuela is Swiss, but it's because she became a Swiss citizen at the age of 14 when her father, who's Mexican, and her mother, who's French, moved there. But she's a Stanford student, and you know, she was the low amateur honors at last year's ANA Inspiration. So she definitely has some experience already on that. She made the cut last year in the U.S. Women's Open, but definitely got smoked by Sophie Schubert. So there you have it with that about Albane Valenzuela. And with that, we'll wrap up our weekend backspin. Now let's talk about what's going to happen this weekend. Of course, there is a big-time news on the Solheim Cup. We have that later for you today. But we're going to have some quick previews here on the forecall of all the tournaments, some of the other tournaments that are going to be. And Fred, you're going to have the PGA Tour and the Windham Championship that is going to be happening this weekend.
Can you believe this is the final event of the PGA Tour's regular season? Can you believe that already? It just seems like 2 weeks ago we started talking about the Masters, you know? I mean, unbelievable. This thing is just, this year has just flown by. So you not only need to watch the leaders this week. We got a tournament in a tournament. You need to watch the leaders at Sedgefield Country Club. You also need to watch those who may play themselves in or out of the FedEx Cup playoffs. This is the last chance for guys near or below number 125 to get into the FedEx Cup playoffs that begin next week with the Northern Trust in Westbury, New York. Historically, 2 to 3 players jump in and out of the top 125 after Wyndham. Right now, Seamus Power is number 123. Daniel Summerhays, 124. Jeff Ogilvie is smack on the bubble at 125. Next, after him come just outside, is Cameron Tringali, Sam Saunders. And Sam Saunders had a great year. I can't believe he's that low. He's been playing really well, especially the last 6 weeks. Ryan Palmer, who's a great player. Billy Hurley III. JT Poston. Graham McDowell. McDowell has status because he's had a win not that long ago. Trey Mullinex, Aaron Baddeley, which Aaron has played pretty well this year. J.J. Henry and Smiley Coffin. Smiley Coffin is one of the young guys, along with Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas, who we look to do big things. So those guys have some work to do if they want to be in the FedEx Cup playoffs and earn their card for next year. Siwoo Kim is the defending champion here at the Wyndham, and the guys are playing for a total purse of $5.8 million with $1.04 going to the winner plus 500 FedEx Cup points. You can see it all on Golf Channel and CBS this week, Carlos.
And there's going to be plenty of action on the other side of the pond in Europe. The European Tour is going to have two tournaments. The first one is the Fiji International that returns to the European Tour for a second year running at the beautiful Natadola Bay. And it's in its fourth edition and features a €1.5 million prize fund. You know, the tournament is tri-sanctioned for the first time this year by the European Tour, the Asian Tour, and the ISPS Handa PGA Tour of Australasia, with the Asian Tour becoming the first one, the last one to join this year. Last year, Brent Snedeker took this crown by blowing away the field by a nine-shot run, but, he's injured, so he's not going to be there to defend his title. But this year will be even more important for Vijay Singh, who, as you all know, is the most notable Fijian player ever, a wonderful ambassador overseas, and is warmly welcome home each year for the Fiji International. He has been working on the redevelopment of the Natadola Bay Championship Golf Course since the day after last year's tournament. The finesse layout will be debuted at the Fiji International with tour professionals, the first to play the course. Vijay will be joined by two other former Masters champions in Angel Cabrera and Mike Weir. Among other notables playing is Scott Henn, who is a two-time European Tour winner and the reigning Asian Tour Order of Merit champion, who finished tied for 10th amongst a star-studded field there at the 2017 WGC Bridgestone Invitational ahead of his miscut this past weekend in what was his second appearance at the PGA Championship at Quail Hollow. But he will be jetting straight from the U.S. to the South Pacific to make his first appearance there. The very international field also includes Brett Rumford, who sealed his sixth European Tour title this year at the ASPS Handa World Super 6 berth. The 18-year-old Pacharakong Watmai from Thailand, who finished in second place behind Rumford there in Australia, and three-time European Tour winner Jungwon Won off Korea. So those would be the stars there. But there's also another tournament on the European Tour schedule, and it's the South Tire Energy Paul Lawrie Match Play. Paul Lawrie's annual tournament will be played in Germany for the first time. It will be played in what is Europe's largest golfing resort, the golf resort Bad Griesbach, which is home to 6 golf courses and has been on the regular European Tour schedule for the past 3 years, having hosted the first 2 editions of the Porsche European Open. This tournament is in its 3rd edition, and the 2 previous winners have been Anthony Wall, who defeated Alex Noren last year, and Kiradek Afi-Barnrad, who won the debut edition. Both previous editions were played in Scotland. The 1999 Open champion, Paul Lawrie, who's also the tournament host, is returning to action after making his 600th European Tour start at the WGC Bridgestone Invitational 2 weeks ago, and the 2-time Ryder Cup player leads a strong field there in Germany. Former European Tour number 1 and current Ryder Cup vice-captain Robert Carlsen is also in the field, having last appeared on the Challenge Tour in an event which he himself hosted. In a similar vein to Lawrie, what he's doing this week. Eduardo Molinari will be hoping to gain some inspiration from his brother Francesco's strong performance there at the PGA Championship last week as he chases a second victory this season, having won the Trofeo Hassan II in April. Belgian Nicolas Colsart and Frenchman Victor Dubuisson add the Ryder Cup winning pedigree to the field, while Marcel Thiem, Max Kiefer, Florian Fritsch, and Alexander Knapp will be all gunning for home glory. Also notable there are youngsters Matthew Pavon and Thomas Dietrich, who will be looking for a breakthrough victory there on the European Tour. And to wrap up the European previews, there's also the Challenge Tour, which is the European equivalent to the Web.com Tour, which is proud to hold the Viking Challenge, which is a new event to the Road to Oman scheduled in this year. This is going to mark the first time they have visited Norway and the Mikkelgaard Golf Club since Benjamin A. Bird's win back in 2014. There are 10 events left on the 26th that are held in 20 different countries, with all players chasing a spot in the top 15 in what is the Road to Oman rankings and a graduation to the European Tour, similar to the top 25 there in the Web.com Tour. But all competitors keep targeting a place on the season-ending NBO Golf Classic Grand Final, where last year Bernd Ritthammer topped the 46-man field to claim his third victory of the season and finished 2016 in 126th place in the official World Golf rankings. This year, what's going on with it? Hey, Englishman Aaron Rye, he leads the way, but he already got promoted after winning his third tournament this year. The 22-year-old is an interesting story. I mean, listen to that name, Aaron Rye. He was dubbed a teenage sensation after beating the Lee Westwood World Putmaster record by holding an astonishing 207 consecutive 10-foot putts as a 15-year-old. Who takes the time to do that? He did, and now he dominated the Challenge Tour. And if you think he's hard to spot, hey, he's not. The promising Englishman is the one proving that two gloves are better than one. He always wears two gloves, so it's easy to see who he is. You know, he look for him. Aaron Rye, he's a star on the rise there on the European Tour. And of interest to us here in the U.S. is that the Americans Julian Suri and Chase Koepka are ranked right now number 2 and number 15, respectfully. The 26-year-old Suri chose to come to Europe in 2016 and started competing on the Challenge Tour, a career-best finish of runner-up at the Open de Portugal at Morgado Golf Resort took him to the top of the Road to Oman rankings in May, and he followed that up with a win late May at the D+D Real Czech Challenge. So he's been there. He's already had the secure car for the European Tour. And Fred, hey, Chase Koepka, who is the 23-year-old younger brother of Brooks, has been finding his place this year. He has not done as well as his big bro did on this tour, but he has 3 top 5 finishes. His latest one was his career best T2 at the Italian Challenge Open by Leones in mid-July. So Chase is definitely looking good there to make the European Tour card for next year.
Yeah, we're going to see Chase a lot more. He's a serious player. He's done pretty well when he's been in stuff. So, hey, Carlos, the Champions Tour is back in action this week. They're going to head to Endicott, New York for the Dick's Sporting Goods Open. Paul Goidos is the defending champion and is the hottest golfer on the senior circuit, having won the 3M Championship last week in Minnesota. In 2016, Goidos won by 2 shots over Wes Short Jr. The Dick's Sporting Goods Open is the first of 6 consecutive tournaments in August and September. After New York, the tour travels west for the Boring Classic and Shaw Charity Classic, followed by 2 tournaments internationally, the Japan Airlines Championship and the Pacific Links Bear Mountain. And then they conclude in California with the Pure Insurance Championship. Top 5 names in the field this week, Charles Schwab Cup leader by a mile, Bernhard Langer, who has also won 3 of the 5 Champions Tour majors this season. Defending champ and last week's winner, Paul Goidos. U.S. Senior Open champ, Kenny Perry. Number 2 in the Charles Schwab Cup ranking, Scotty McCarron. And Corey Pavin, who's coming off a runner-up at the Senior Open Championship. So A pretty good field in New York for the Dick's Sporting Goods Open, Carlos.
Hey, there are only two events left on the Web.com Tour regular season, and the race to be on the 25 is getting intense, but with eight of the top 20 out in this tournament, that sets the stage for those barely in the bubble or just trying to get a win that would catapult them into the coveted top 25. Martin Piller, who won the Ellie Mae Classic 2 weeks ago, this week dropped from 24. He was in, and now he's 26. He's out. So 1 week you're in, 1 week you're out. And surprisingly, he's not playing this week. Neither is number 26, Tom Lovelady, who jumped from 34 to 26 this week. So I don't know. To 27. So those two are right there in the bubble, and they're not playing. Piller is $10,000 behind, and Lovelady is $17,000. So not playing here could create an enormous pressure cooker on the event that is going to be the final on the regular season for them. And if you don't think this tournament can make a difference, just look at the difference. A 10-foot putt can make in a guy's life. J.J. Spahn, he drained his on the 72nd hole to win last year's edition and was catapulted to a prosperous rookie year on the PGA Tour. Sam Ryder, on the other hand, missed his, losing out on an opportunity to tie Spahn and ended up spending another year chasing pro golf's ultimate goal, which is a PGA Tour card. Given Ryder is sitting solidly in fourth this year thanks to a win and five top 10 finishes, but it took him one more year to qualify for the PGA Tour. So, you know, it just goes to show where that there will be no margin for error this week when the Web.com Tour stops in Knoxville for the 28th consecutive year. You know, Foxton Country Club is a 7,100-yard par 72 layout in Farragut and has hosted the event since 1998. But the logistics will have to cause some significant changes in the Web.com Tour event that, as I said, has been stopping there for the past 28 years. In an effort to help with travel concerns for the players and tour officials, the 2018 tournament will be contested over Mother's Day weekend, which is May 7th through the 13th. Tournament director Patrick Nicol said next year's Knoxville engagement will be part of a three-city loop that will feature stops in Evansville, Indiana, which will be April 23 to the 29th, Knoxville, and then Nashville, May 21st to the 27th. The Knoxville tournament had been played in June from 2001 to 2009, then moved to August in 2010. Fred, you know, the issue here is that after the players wrap up playing the new Sentinel Open presented by Pilot on Sunday, they have to pack their bags for the next event that is cross-country in Portland, Oregon. And that, Fred, can be very difficult, a very difficult turnaround for cash-strapped youngsters.
Yeah, that is a big deal. They usually try to get it so they can drive or have some time to travel in between. And a lot of them travel in vans or cars or, you know, and they have their wife and maybe a couple small kids with them. So, yeah, that's a big deal for these guys. Hey, Carlos, the U.S. Amateur is currently underway in Southern California. Medal play started yesterday. It's split between Bel Air Country Club and Riviera. Hayden Wood, Norman Zong, and Mark Lawrence all fired 64s yesterday and were tied after the first round. The second round is in progress as we speak. Hayden Wood has finished his round at Bel Air Country Club. He shot a 67 today, so he's currently leading at 131. But Norman Zong is only on the 14th hole at Bel Air. He's three shots back of Wood. If he'd get hot, he could still catch him. And Martin Lawrence has fallen down to tie for 32 over today. So they're going to go. 312 amateurs are competing at both courses. That's why they're using two courses, because they brought so many amateurs in. They're competing for the 64 match play spot that will begin tomorrow on Wednesday with the final match on Sunday. That will be, and all this is going to be televised on the Fox channel. So great amateur golf match play Wednesday through Sunday. It's always good stuff, especially Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. when you're going to get some upsets, and match play is always fun to watch. So if you have time, check out the U.S. Amateur on Fox Networks.
And with that, we wrap up the four-call or the look ahead to this weekend's action, but we still have one big one. We haven't talked a word about it. That's, well, we have talked about two words, Solheim Cup. But that'll be on the practice range where we're going to have everything you need to know about it. Now, it's time for the Par 5 News. And Fred, you're going to tee it off as usual, but this time you're going to be talking about somebody we haven't been talking a lot lately, but he, when we talk about him, he has to be on the tee shot on the Par 5 News, and that's Tiger Woods.
Yeah, before I get to that, Carlos, I want to mention that NWL Golf Links, a couple weeks ago we came out with the first ever summer travel issue, and we featured six golf resorts in Michigan. So if you're thinking about getting a summer golf getaway yet and you don't know anything about Michigan, Michigan has fantastic golf, great deals. So it's very affordable. So find an issue, check on nwo.back9mediagroup.com. Click on the cover, that's the summer travel issue, and check those out. And also, the August issue just came out. It features Gull Lake View Resort in the Battle Creek, Kalamazoo area. They have six golf courses there. So every day you can stay there five, six, 7 days, play a different golf course every day. Fantastic place, great value. And you can also find that feature in the August issue of NWO Golf Links at nwo.back9mediagroup.com with the number 9 in it. So, yeah, Carlos, you mentioned Tiger, and, you know, we've been doing this show for over, what, 4 years, 4.5 years? And, you know, probably 50% of those shows, if you went back and checked, at least 40%, our first news item was probably about Tiger Woods. And we got Tiger on the top of the tee sheet here for the Par 5 News tonight. And he didn't even have to stop by the court for his arraignment last Wednesday. He was, after all, much too busy diving for lobsters off the Bahamas to be bothered with the mundane tasks of human life. His attorney did enter a plea of not guilty for the DUI he was written up for by police who found him sleeping and unresponsive in his car in the early hours of May 29th. He was clearly unable to safely operate a motor vehicle. The lawyer announced that Woods will enter a first-time DUI offenders program that would reduce the charge from DUI to reckless driving. I guess maybe reckless sleeping would be more appropriate. Woods was approximately 15 miles from his home when police found him pulled off the side of the street with his car running and sleeping in his vehicle. Woods admitted to taking painkillers and has since completed treatment at a private clinic to deal with his use of prescription medicines. If you're interested in that kind of thing, you can go on Facebook. It's all over the cocktail that he was taking and all the stuff that was in there. If I would take it, it probably would have killed me, but if you're interested in that kind of stuff. According to court records, prosecutors filed a reckless driving charge on Tuesday, and Woods is scheduled to appear in court in October. So Tiger has already completed a private rehab and will end up with a fine plus a warning to watch what he's doing and admonish to be more careful next time. Just another blip on the radar for the 14-time major champ, who seems to be floundering slightly with his golf career on hold from the back surgeries, sponsors fleeing a sinking ship, and coming to the realization that his golfing days may be over. What is to become of one of the greatest golfers any generation has seen is totally up to him. Carlos, just as in golf, it's not about the shot you've already hit, but what are you going to do with that next shot? That's the important thing, Carlos. And Tiger needs to consider that.
Vicodin, Dilaudid, Xanax, Ambien, and THC. That was the cocktail that he had. Just in case anyone wanted to know, those were the five painkillers that, well, not painkiller, it was just two painkillers, two sleep drugs, and a chemical ingredient in the other one. But the funny thing is that, well, not funny. It's not funny, really. We've seen him, and I mentioned this last week when we talked about him showing off there his the lobster that he had, he was handling there when he went with his kids diving there to get that big lobster. But now he's been so active lately in social media. And on the day of the toxicology report leak, he posted a picture of him and Justin Thomas with the Wanamaker trophy at a dinner with Thomas' family and friends. I mean, this follows those recent images of him with Barcelona stars Lionel Messi and Luis Suarez, and the one that we just mentioned of him last year fishing with his children. I think, I don't know, I'm going to ask you this to your take before we move on, but it's, he's not only undergoing some assistance with his painkillers. I mean, this program that he had to manage his medications after he was speculated that he was addicted to painkillers. But he also revealed yesterday in that statement through a spokesman that he has also been suffering with insomnia. So it's not only those two things. But I think there's also like a rebuild of his image. Because of all these things that he has gone through, I think that he's looking somehow to rebuild also his image for when he returns, if he ever does, which seems like it's going to happen. He's going to return at some point. What do you think? I mean, we've seen stars go through this big falls. I mean, we saw Kobe Bryant. We saw all kinds of stars, even Michael Jordan. A lot of stars that have taken a lot of heat. Sometimes they fall, but then there's this rebuilding of the image, and all of a sudden he's back on top. I mean, he's never lost the ability to move the needle, but what you think about this all of a sudden becoming a social butterfly?
This started actually some time ago, Carlos, at least 2 years ago, when he showed up at the Quicken Loans when it was up at D.C. At Congressional. And he was forthcoming with reporters. He was much more open. This has been going on for a while. But what you're noticing right now, this latest campaign, is definitely a PR program to have a better image for Tiger. You know, he only has communicated with anyone, really, through his website or Twitter, or in a formal media setting when he's at a tournament. And, you know, his image was not good. People, you know, he's a jerk, okay, to everyone. People are really tired of it. So they were looking for reasons to knock him down. They couldn't when he kept winning all the time. And the PGA Tour was behind him because he was their marquee guy, so they're not going to let anybody publish anything negative about him. Well, you know, when he goes out and does all this stuff, he just adds fuel to the fire. And so anybody can jump on, and now it's fun to jump on and beat Tiger down because he's going through these problems for whatever reason. And so, yes, it's a big PR campaign for sure, Carlos. And he likes to use he's been using Facebook more. He likes to use Twitter, and he uses his web page, TigerWoods.com. But he needs to do a lot of work. He's been in a bubble so long. He needs to understand that, you know, he's just a person, and other people want to find out about him. And so maybe one of these days he'll get it. But I don't think so, because he lives in that big mansion down there in Jupiter, and he's got guards around him. He's got another, you know, guarded place in Albany and a big guarded place in L.A., and who knows where else. He's probably got a penthouse suite in New York someplace. But, he lives a different life than what you and I live, and he thinks he's entitled to a lot more stuff than what you and I are. So, and when things happen to him like happened at the end of May, people just eat that stuff up, Carlos.
They do, and that's why sometimes you have to feel bad for him, because even though, think what you think about him, but there's a person behind that, and he has his sort of problems, and like you mentioned, he lives another life, but at the same time, he needs that protection because of the noticeability that he has. He should have just been more open since the beginning, like he's being right now towards everybody, and maybe he wouldn't have fallen to this. But, hey, the better to him. Hopefully we can see him maybe next year playing again and see how he can fare. Hopefully he can come back. Hey, the latest European Tour has revealed that its CEO, Ivan Kudabakis, is leaving his position. Is leaving his position. No, that's the official.
And not a moment too soon.
No, man. I would have packed his bags and take him out of the office immediately. I offer myself, I'll take a plane, I'll take him out right now.
Right.
But Chairman Mark Lichtenstein has been asked by the LED board to take over the day-to-day duties in his absence. Kubadakis has been under fire with the LED struggling to hold on to two events. The German's departure comes following the cancellation of two tournaments on the LED schedule, bringing the total of number X competitions this season to 7, making it particularly difficult for those on that side of the pond to qualify for this weekend's Solheim Cup. As recently as yesterday, as last Monday, players received an email saying that the Xiamen International Ladies Open had been canceled due to a lack of funding and that Qatar is unlikely to take place. I mean, that was yesterday. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Kudabakis was not at either the Scottish Open or British Open in the last couple of weeks, which was leading already to the speculation that he was on gardening leave. Players were advised not to make any comments on his whereabouts or the lack of events to be played in. Yeah, well, the rest of the players said nothing about the future of the tour. One of Europe's leading lights obviously didn't get the memo there at King's Barnes, and you should know where she's from. I mean, Kieran is from there, so you should know that they don't say shut up. And that was Scotland's Katrina Matthew. She was one of a number of players to call out for Kudabakis' exit. Matthew, she thinks that the product is there and said, and I quote, they have got a lot of good players. It's just perhaps they have had the wrong person at the head. So hopefully, if they can get that resolved, it can start building itself up again. End of quote. There's a problem there, Fred, because the Ladies European Tour has had upwards of 20 CEOs since 1979. That kind of management turnover doesn't foster organizational stability, let alone organizational growth and prosperity. The Ladies European Tour is at a critical crossroads. Will it turn to LPGA's Michael Wan and transition to a feeder tour for the LPGA, or consider a merger with the Men's European Tour, or attempt to identify a new CEO and battle its way back to financial and organizational health? You know, both an affiliation with the LPGA and a merger with the European Tour appear to be viable options at this point, and both would ensure that emerging European players could forge viable career paths. At this point, the future of women's pro golf in Europe.
Carlos, you just went off there for whatever reason, let me just follow up on your point here. There, you're back.
Can you hear me now?
Okay, you're back.
Can you hear me now?
I can. Go ahead. Okay. Finish up what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, the LPGA Commissioner Mike Wan was asked late last year about the LPGA's interest in taking the Ladies European Tour under its umbrella and forming a satellite circuit to feed pros into the LPGA, much like the Symetra Tour right now. He said then, and I quote, "My vision is not to acquire the Ladies European Tour. We've got a good partnership," end of quote. You know, the Ladies European Tour website now lists just 15 events on its schedule, down 11 from 6 years ago. And beyond the majors, it has hosted just 6 events this season. Fred, the only problem I see with the LPGA acquiring the Ladies European Tour is how will the qualifying process for the European Solheim Cup team will work? Because if you convert it into a feeder, then you have to really reinvent the whole qualifying process since you eliminate the Ladies European Tour ranking points. To me, it makes more sense that the European Tour would merge with it, and that was obviously the vision that right now Keith Pelley's having could spark some progress there, but really, definitely, the latest European Tour is a very, very risky crossroads right now.
Well, number one, I see the European Tour. They have their own financial problems. So, you know, the Ryder Cup kind of keeps them fluid every couple years. If they didn't have the Ryder Cup money, they would have maybe been out of business about 8-10 years ago, unless they would have drastically changed what they were doing. And it's still today, they need that Ryder Cup money every couple years to keep things floating over there. Now, Pelle is doing a fantastic job. You and I talk about this all the time, of changing the game over there. And this Rolex Series seems to have been a real winner for him, that 7 or 8 tournaments that have that bigger purses, and so the guys are showing up to play in it that he really needs to keep the TV ratings up there. The problem that the Ladies European Tour had, and Carlos, they talked about this when I was over there, 3 years ago, whenever I was there, they need TV, and they can't afford to bring TV in. To bring TV in to a tournament, like when Golf Channel comes in, it costs around $500,000 to $750,000. Okay, you got to get somebody to pay for that. The tournament can't pay for it. They need big sponsors to do that. And so the key job of a tour office like the Ladies European Tour is to find the sponsors that are going to pay to get the TV in there. The women can take smaller purses. They will live with smaller purses if the sponsors don't want to pony up the money for the big purse. They can cut the purse. They'll gladly do that. Okay, they don't want to, but they will. But they got to get the sponsors to pay for the TV. It's kind of like the chicken and the egg. You've got to have the TV, or you don't have a tournament, because the crowds aren't big enough, especially in Europe, to get a gate to pay for the purses. So that's the problem. So number one, the European Tour, I don't know if they're strong enough to take on a loser like the Ladies European Tour right now, unless there's a golden goose at the end there that wants to come in and pick up the sponsor thing of the whole. Remember, like years ago when Virginia Slims came in and underwrote the whole all of the LPGA, and you know the Sumatra is doing the same thing. You know, you had Nike for a long time on the Web.com tour, then Hogan Company. So they need a big sponsor like that, first of all. That could be the golden goose right away. But I really, you know, Michael Wan would deny it. If you ask him, he would deny it, say he's not interested. But I know he's aggressive enough, and I know he's looking at it, because the LPGA is an international tour. And you know he would love to be in those European markets. You know he would. But, Carlos, I see it as LPGA and LPGA Europe. I think it would still be two separate entities. I don't think it would be a feeder tour. I think that the sponsorship were there. And if you had a CEO come in there like a Michael Wan that could go over there and line up the sponsors, I think it could be done. I think the LPGA is the best option for those guys from where I sit, in my humble opinion, and I'm looking at it, that's what I'm seeing. But then the LPGA could be a truly international tour. They could have a couple different segments that way, and you'd still do the Solheim Cup. I think it would be good. Another big player in this thing, and I don't know if she's so busy, I don't know if she wants to take on the responsibility, but if you could get Annika Sorenstam involved, like the PGA and the PGA Tour and the USGA uses Jack Nicklaus, Annika, if she would get involved over there, she could rally the sponsors and help bring the money together for more. I mean, they should have at least 15 to 18 tournaments a year on the Ladies European Tour. I mean, the continent's big enough. You got England, you got Scotland, you got France, you got Spain. Right there, you should be able to have 15 tournaments, for goodness sake. I don't know. It's a real mess. They need to get and pay a really strong chief executive. Now, if they merge with the LPGA Tour, then they get Michael Wan. I don't know. But it starts at the head. The head guy has not been doing a very good job, Carlos.
Now, 20 CEOs since 1979. I mean, we're talking about 37 years, and 20 is almost one CEO every 1.5 years. So that really doesn't work. And well, if your thought is that LPGA Europe, my only concern is, like I'm saying, that I wouldn't like the Solheim Cup to be affected, like it's been right now.
Yeah.
It's really being very, very big time affected, because only 11 tournaments. I mean, they have done this, 15 on its schedule, and they have.
Well, look at the two top qualifiers from the LNT.
Six events this year. Yeah, and only six events this year.
Yeah.
It's incredible. How are they going to get a chance to qualify? Now, I do agree that if they call it LPGA Europe and keep it separate, okay, so they can have that. But I don't know. I just think, to me, both are viable options. That's why I see it that way. But I understand your point about the money, but I think Keith is going that way, that route. It's not now. It's going to take maybe a couple more years, but he's going that route right now. And either Michael One or Keith Bailey are going to do great things if either one of them get him under their wing. So I would be happy with either one of them, as long as there is no other guy like this guy that was there right now, or any of the previous 20 that really have done that much about the Ladies European Tour.
Carlos, you ready to move on to the next subject?
Yes, sir. Your turn. Mark Rolfing.
You know, Rolfing's kind of a unique character. We see him on TV, but, you know, he's been a PGA Tour professional. He owned and managed his own media company. He, of course, is a well-known announcer for NBC now. But he and his wife have also been very involved in improving children's lives. Since 1990, the Mark and Debbie Rolfing Charitable Foundation has worked to improve the lives of high-risk and underserved children in need, and have been licensed foster parents for 18 years. Through their cradle care ministry, Debbie and Mark have personally welcomed, loved, and provided care in their home for 28 newborns, the majority needing medical and often they're critically fragile at birth. They need a lot of care, a lot of attention. And their nurturing care has provided time for these fragile children to prosper, while adoption attorneys and case managers assess if the children can be reunited with their parents or be placed with other adoptive families. Mark, of course, also survived a bout with salivary gland cancer that was diagnosed in 2015. And during his post-surgery recovery at the University of Chicago Medical Center, he routinely went past Jackson Park, which spawned his most recent idea for growth of the game initiative. The Chicago Parks Golf Alliance was established with a mission to attract the next generation of golfers to Jackson Park by providing equipment, instruction, and mentoring to youth on the city's south side. In recognizing the Rolfings at last week's PGA Championship, PGA of America President Paul Levy said, "Mark and Debbie Rolfings' combined energy and passion for their beloved Hawaii has spread across the country to help grow the game of golf while balancing a selfless commitment to benefit the lives of children. Mark and Debbie have touched the lives of many through golf, which is a powerful vehicle to better the lives of others. Because of their endeavors, the PGA of America is extremely proud to present them with the PGA Distinguished Service Award." Carlos, Mark Rolfing is seen primarily as just a golf announcer on television, but he has been so much more, and reminds us all that golf is a sport that can be used to help others and make life better for everyone. Congratulations to the Rolfings on this wonderful award. Carlos?
Oh, totally, totally. Congratulations. And like you say, there's a lot of things people don't see that golf personalities do to better our lifestyle, the community, you know, through charities and all that. There's a lot of things that I hope that it could be more taken to the public eyes so that they would know, really, like you say, golf is more than just a sport. There's a way that it really contributes to the better of the communities everywhere that is played. Hey, Fred, you know, after two shoulder surgeries in 2014, J.J. Killeen found himself weighing his career options. He could continue playing on the Web.com Tour, as he had for much of the previous decade. At the same time, he was brainstorming with some Lubbock, Texas high school buddies who talked about the idea of developing a Topgolf-style entertainment concept for the city, home to Texas Tech University and nearly 300,000 residents. 2.5 years later, their idea has become a reality. This past Friday, 4, which is written the number 4, O-R-E, a golf and entertainment facility opened with 60 tee boxes, a 286-yard range, 3 bars, a restaurant that seats 200 guests, an eclectic food and beverage menu, and 2,500 square feet of meeting space for business groups. The facility uses FlightScope technology to track the ball flight. Players will have the option of playing 1 of 4 games or simply just practicing. The games ranging from a rudimentary pinball game that's geared toward beginners to more advanced games can be handicapped based on playing ability, according to Patrick Wynn, who's Four's general manager. Four is managed by Troon Golf, the Scottsdale, Arizona course management firm. The facility will use Callaway golf practice balls and stock Callaway equipment for guests who do not bring their own clubs. Four chose Callaway because of the manufacturer's relationship with Troon. You know, Killeen's Four managing partner and the spokesman for the local investors backing the project also will serve as the director of golf. Aside from FlightScope and Trackman, he'll have a private short game area and putting green to work with students. The building faces east, blocking the westerly winds, and there are natural gas heaters and misting fans to accommodate year-round play. While Wynn and Killeen say they want to introduce beginners to golf, they also understand that many of their guests will be there primarily to socialize. There will be live music on weekends and an adults-only lounge called The Loft. Wynn said that they wanted an area that's a little more private, more intimate. The rest of the facility is going to be high energy. You know, the idea might reflect a natural evolution within the golf and entertainment sector. Topgolf is expanding steadily in major cities, but there's still a vacuum in secondary markets. Perhaps there's a window for a similar concept to fill that void, not unlike the way Hibbert Sports expanded over the past 2 decades in rural markets, while larger competitors such as Dick's Sporting Goods were focused on major cities. For now, though, Killeen said the goal is to get it the first 4 right. Fred, he said that they can't even come close to doing something like expanding like Topgolf has done until they get this one right, but that when they get that figure out, then he thinks that that would be anyone's goal.
Yeah, you mentioned this sounds an awful lot like Top Golf to me, and you know, we've talked about Top Golf different times over the last couple of years, and I recently had the opportunity to visit Top Golf facility in the Washington D.C. area. You know, the National Golf Foundation has reported that Top Golf facilities are bringing in around 10 million new golfers to the game every year. Well, you know, I'm not seeing that. After I went there, I understand what they're saying, but the people at a Top Golf facility or the people that are going to be at this four, they're not real golfers, Carlos. They're there for the social activities. Just like you said, you know, there's a nice bar and a nice restaurant, and you can get good food and you can drink what you want. When we were there, on one side of us, there was a bachelorette party going on, and they were nowhere near anything considering being golfers. Okay, they were just having a good time, which is fine. on the other side of us, there was a man and his wife and three or four kids. The kids were all on their smartphones or tablets while Dad was hitting a few balls. It was kind of like a forced family fun kind of thing, and they were not golfers. So the idea that Topgolf or ForGolf is going to bring more golfers to a green grass facility that actually play golf or go to a golf course, that's a pretty small percentage, if any percentage at all. So, you know, bottom line for these kind of places, Carlos, I'm for anything. You and I both agree that are going to bring more golfers to the sport, but I'm not too sure very many of Topgolf's 10 million visitors will ever step a foot, Joy, onto a green grass golf course.
You want me to tell you a number? You want me to tell you? You said pretty slow. I would say none, man. None. Whoever is a golfer that wants to have a fun time with his family, maybe in a different thing, might go there, a real golfer. But new people that go there know they're not going to find that same kind of entertainment and socializing in a golf facility.
No.
They're never stepping one foot on a golf course. Never. Yeah. Unfortunately, and I'm sorry, but I have to agree with you on this one. No way. No way they do that.
Yeah. And it's great. It was fine. It was wonderful. There are some problems with it. I'm going to put an article. I wrote an article up for the September issue of NW Golf Links. Maybe we can talk about that later. But it was a fun experience. We had a great time. Went with my son and my wife. But it's not bringing more golfers to golf courses, Carlos, anytime soon.
No, it doesn't, definitely. Hey, you're going to wrap up talking to us about Kyle Miller, no? Or are we done?
No, yes, I have it. You assigned me this story. I had heard about it, but I didn't pick up on it, and you put this in here and assigned it to me, and I got to doing the research on it, and I'm really glad you did, Carlos, because this is exactly the kind of thing I like to talk about. In a truly inspirational story, Kyle Miller became the first golfer with cerebral palsy to compete in a PGA Tour-sponsored event when he teed up last week on a sponsor's exemption at the ATB Financial Classic in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, a stop on the PGA Tour's Mackenzie Tour, formerly the Canadian Tour, which we were talking about earlier. Miller didn't win the event by any stretch of the imagination. Chase Wright posted 15 under par to get the win. Miller finished dead last in the field, posting 108 and 88 to miss the cut by a mile. But the simple fact that he has endured to earn the status to compete in a professional event is absolutely mind-blowing. He's endured 14 surgeries just to rebuild his left hand and rotate his left leg. Operations that left him with permanent numbness all along the left side of his body. Miller, who is 26, passed the PGA playing ability test 4 years ago to earn professional credentials. So, you know, to become a PGA professional, I think you have to shoot like 150 normally. You know, 75 is a 36-hole deal. So you usually have to shoot 75, depending on the difficulty of the golf course, but around there. So on a regular golf course, he can shoot, six over par for two rounds. So that's pretty good, okay? Now, when he goes to a professional tournament, he shoots 100, but that's a whole different world, as we talked about with Steph Curry going and playing. You know, he's a pretty good player. He's a scratch golfer, but these guys on web.com, they're +4, okay? You're not going to compete with these guys. Same way here in the Mackenzie Tour, these guys are probably +2, okay, handicaps, so they're really good. So he did pass the playability, and he received his teaching credentials. He teaches at Golf Tech. He's given over 8,000 lessons. His presence on a fairway is a tribute to the trust and commitment it took for him to overcome so many obstacles in his life. You know, the story is about how far Miller has come. He suffered a stroke after being born a month early. At birth, he develops this at birth. He struggled with muscle movement and coordination, tone, and reflex for his entire life. You know, but he never left his hand problem or any of his problems stifle his dreams. At the age of 11, he found some old golf clubs in a garage and became infatuated with the game of golf. One day, he hobbled into the Inglewood Golf Club in his home of Calgary with a bag and three clubs and a question for the local golf professional, Marty Desmaris, who was a former minor league hockey player. He asked Miller how to play and would he teach him how. And when Desmaris said yes, the young boy cried. He'd already been told by two other pros he'd never amount to much in golf. So, you know, Desmaris respected the young boy's commitment and worked with him and you know, taught him some stuff. And one day, Miller showed up at Inglewood with a black eye. And he quizzed him, you know, wanted to know how he got that, and the boy told him. And when he got right in the car, he drove over to Miller's home. The father was a biker and a drinker, and he went up to the door and he told his father, "You do not treat this boy the way you treat him." We packed up his clothes and he moved in with Desmaris. All through this time, Miller's surgeries corrected his left hand and leg. It had to be broken so that they could rotate it and set it correctly, then rehabilitation. You know, one day his doctor marveled at his recovery and asked his mother what Kyle was doing to progressively improve. And she told him he was playing golf. And the doctor replied, "Keep him playing. It's saving his life." Carlos, you know, people with cerebral palsy, they just kind of keep going downhill. They don't really get better. Mm-hmm. This boy has beaten the odds. And so Miller has said, after 20-plus years of chasing this dream, the odds of somebody becoming a golf professional is less than 1%. The odds of someone with cerebral palsy becoming a golf professional, well, he's still trying to figure that one out. So, Carlos, as you know, these are the types of stories I love to talk about. We have friends like Richie O'Brien is one of the thousands of people who has used golf as therapy to rehabilitate after serious injury or illness. Mark Cross, Hi Anderson, and Kathy Gildersleeve Jensen as well, as countless other golf professionals use golf to help our former enlisted military personnel to overcome physical and mental issues through the PGA's Reach and PGA Hope program. So, Carlos, congrats to Kyle Miller for surviving and striving to improve every day, using that game of golf as his impetus to drive that fire to succeed. What a great story. Thank you for pointing it out to me, Carlos.
And he might not have won the tournament. He was a winner just by stepping into that golf course. I get goosebumps just right now saying this, because that's those kinds of feel-good stories. As soon as I saw it, I said, no, this has to go in there. This has to go in there. Like we've been saying, we have to talk more about these kinds of stories, because that's what really makes golf and life more enjoyable. So congratulations. I really second that, and hopefully he'll go on and play many more. And with that, we wrap up our Par 5 news. Now it's time for what you have been waiting for. It is the practice range, and we're going to talk about the Solheim Cup. That is this weekend. The LPGA is going to take a break from its normal tournament schedule for playing the 2017 Solheim Cup. As you all know, this is a biennial golf tournament for professional women golfers that is contested by players from the U.S. and the Europe. It is named after the Norwegian-American golf club manufacturer Carsten Solheim, who was a driving force behind its creation. The inaugural Cup was held back in 1990, and the event was staged in an even numbers until 2002, alternating years with the Ryder Cup, the equivalent men's event between the USA and Europe. Because of the attacks of September 11, 2001, forcing the postponement of the Ryder Cup, the Solheim Cup was switched to odd number years in 2003. The event is played over 3 days, and you, Fred, are going to talk about the format about it, but they play 28 matches since 2002. And the course that they're going to be playing, I mean, on the history, I mean, the U.S. has won 9, the Europe has won 5, and the course that they're going to be played is the Des Moines Golf and Country Club, which is a private country club there in West Des Moines in Iowa. It's just located a few minutes west of Des Moines. Its golf courses have been consistently being ranked in the top 10 golf courses in the state of Iowa. It was established in 1999, but it established its current site in 1970. It has moved over 3 different places now in his fourth. It's his last one, and he's been there since 1970. It has 36 holes on 2 courses, which is the North Course, which is a par 72 that can extend up to 7,300 and 1 yards, and the South Course, where they will be playing the Cup, which is a par 73, which can extend up to 7,103 yards. But for this competition, it will be 6,894 yards. Now, keep in mind that the average yardage for an LPGA Tour golf course is between 6,200 and 6,600 yards. So this one is going to be playing almost 300 yards above the maximum average. Now, you would say, oh, well, that course is set up for the bombers in, and those are the ones that are going to have the biggest impact in this Solheim Cup. Let me just tell you two words, or actually a name, before you judge that. That course was designed, both courses were designed by Pete Dye. You never have a good time with that. So it's going to be an interesting course. I mean, the first hole, it's a short reachable par 4 that looks very inviting from the tee box, but you can't be fooled. I mean, Pete Dye tempts the players there with a benign appearing opening hole, but it's a beast. I mean, there's a tee shot of 225 yards that you have to put the player in position in order to do that. There's 2 holes that are over almost 600 yards, which really one of them has a dogleg, and that's the 9th hole, and the 11th hole is a straight up very, very narrow. So it's really a lot of strategy is going to be played here. It reminds me a lot of how they had to play at the Olympics, where there was a little bit of everything. I mean, you're not going to see one type of player really benefiting from the course. It's really going to take a lot of strategy involved here. So, which brings us to how they're going to be, the captains are going to be making their adjustments. I mean, the format, which, Fred, you're going to be talking about it now, is going to be very important how they're going to pair the players there, because it's really, really going to be very interesting, because they have to adapt to this South Course, which really, really looks inviting. But hey, it's Pete Dye. Nothing is inviting.
Well, you know, when you say that you know it is very long, that may explain the Angel Yin choice for Julie Inkster, because she's a bomber, right? She hits it a long way, so. Maybe that's really one of the reasons you wonder. But, yeah, Carl, let's just talk just a little bit about format. Of course, the first 2 days, Friday and Saturday, are always the team matches. And so you have one session of four-ball and then one session of foursomes. And so four-ball, you know, it's good to match. Which four ball is you, both players on a team play their own ball, and at the end of the hole, you take the lowest score of the two players against the other two players. So it's good to match a consistent player with an aggressive player. The conservative player can assure pars with the occasional birdie to allow the more aggressive player to go for it on every hole. Great teams over the years. Freddie Couples and Davis Love won the World Cup, Match Play Cup, numerous times. Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer, same thing. Tiger Woods and Steve Stricker were a great team in Ryder Cups, President's Cups, and in World Cup. And they were great at four ball. with the U.S. Solheim Cup team, for example, you could put Lexi Thompson, one of the longest hitters on the LPGA, and an aggressive player, and she could be paired with, say, Stacey Lewis, who is very consistent, you know, lots of fairways, lots of greens in regulation, lots of pars. So those are the kind of things you look for in four ball. And in foursomes, it's a little different. We don't play a lot of foursomes in the U.S., but they do play it on a regular basis, especially in amateur events in Europe. In foursomes, two players play one ball only, and they take turns through the hole. One person hits the drive, the next player hits the second shot, the next player chips or putts, whatever, and then until the hole is completed. The players decide before the first tee who will tee off on the even and odd holes. And that depends, again, if strategy comes into play, it depends on where the par 3 and the par 4s or the par 5s lay on the course. If you have a stronger iron player on the team, on that pairing, you would want that player playing, teeing off on the par 3 holes, for example. If you have a longer hitter, you may want to maximize tee shots on the par 5. So it depends a little bit on how the course is set up, and so that comes into play before they even play off. But the real secret to playing foursomes is for both players to be comfortable with each other. Personalities matter more in foursomes, I think, than anything else. If the players don't really like each other to begin with, they're going to be a terrible foursome team because one of the players is going to hit a bad shot into a bad place. The other partner is going to be mad at the other player for the rest of the round. So each player has to be happy playing the shot that their partner gives them. They can't, you know, be yelling at them for hitting a bad shot or something. So foursomes is a little different. Is a little different deal. And so, Carlos, you mentioned a total of 28 points. So, of course, every match earns a total of 1 point for the win. So there are four foursomes and four four-ball matches on Friday and Saturday. So that's a total of 8 points each day, or 16 points. And then there's the 12 singles matches on Sunday, and that totals up to 28. It takes 14.5 points to win the Solheim Cup outright, or for the U.S., they just need to win 14 and have the match or tie it to retain the cup. And last year, or 2 years ago, in Germany, the U.S. squeaked out a one-point win. It was 14.5 to 13.5. It was the closest Solheim Cup it's ever been. So that's a little bit about the format, a little bit about the scoring, Carlos.
And it's a really insightful, and like you were saying, I think that when they're going to be playing the alternate shots, they're going to be really you're going to have to have a very nice pairing because, like I was saying, this course, you say you can put an aggressive player with a consistent player, and I think both teams were balanced in that, and I think that's what, like you said, Angel Jin definitely has a lot of power. I think that was what was really missing maybe from that pick. And maybe that's the reason why she didn't went with any of the other veteran players besides Angel Jin. Well, we'll talk about that later. But anyway, let's talk about the teams now. Let's start with the European team. Where the captain is Annika Sorenstam, which is her first year as a captain. Served as an assistant captain in the past three Solheim Cups, has appeared in 8 Solheim Cups with a 22-11-4 overall record, and those 22 matches that she has played ties her with Laura Davis for most all-time, and her 24 points earned is second all-time behind Davis. The assistant captains will be Katrina Mathieu, who was still in the running maybe for a wild card there, so that made it difficult for Annika, as she admitted that they had to be talking about the possible wild cards, and she was one of them, and she was also an assistant captain, so she's going to be there. Katrina has been in plenty of Solheim Cups. Marta Figueras Dotti and Maria McBride are the other two. The players, Anna Nordqvist, who is from Sweden, she's the highest ranked player that they have there. She's the number 13 in the world, 30 years old, her fifth Solheim Cup, 4-8-7-1. She has never had a losing record in any match. Definitely she'll be the anchor in this team, the one of the consistent players. Annika Sørenstam said it was a no-brainer to select her fellow Swede. I mean, she's the highest-ranked player on her side. And she breathes also a sigh of relief, too, because Nordqvist, and we have seen this, said this a couple of weeks ago, she had been out of action part of the summer because she was suffering from mononucleosis. But she was in better health by the Ricoh Women's British Open, where she closed with a 67 to tie for 7. So few players, you know, have made a quicker impact in the LPGA than Nordqvist, who now lives in Orlando, Florida, and just her 50th win, she won the 2009 LPGA Championship. She definitely is the anchor for this team. Carlota Siganda, who's the second player there, 20th in the world rankings, she's definitely the consistent player. She's consistent. She's 22nd on the LPGA money list and hasn't missed a cut after failing to play the weekend four times in 2016. She had her second-best career major finish at the U.S. Women's Open, time for fifth, and she knows she has the experience here. She has played twice. She has a 4-1-2 record, and she's definitely one of those consistent players that Annika Sørenstam has. 23 in the world is Suzanne Pedersen from Norway, 36 years old, 16-11-6. She is in her seventh Solheim Cup, and she's like the Ian Poulter on the ladies' Solheim Cup here on the European side. She is fiery. She has been a huge part of the Europe Solheim Cup team. With, like I said, this is her ninth consecutive appearance in the competition. Her vast experience in the event is mirroring that of her American counterpart, Kirsty Kerr. But like I said, she's going to bring fire into this team. Another fiery player who reminds me a lot of her, maybe an upgrade because she has more power, but it's already at 21 in her third Solheim Cup, is Charlie Hall, who has a 6-2-0 record already here on the Solheim Cup, and she definitely is already, you know, on the record books as the youngest golfer at 17 to participate in the event. She was impressive that time. She went 2-1-0, including 5-4 singles win over Paula Creamer. So 2 years after she paired with Suzanne Pedersen in that controversial match against Alison Lee and Brittany Lincecum. But hey, she was the Rookie of the Year there at the lead, and she's one of the top players there and one of the power players in the in the Solheim Cup. Jody Warchadov, 29 years old, her second Solheim Cup. She has a 2-1-0 record. She's another one of those consistent players. Karini Kerr, 38 years old, her fourth Solheim Cup, 5-4-1, her record. Georgia Hall, one of the rookies that is coming in here. She really is one of those great players. She's just 21 years old, but she is fiery. She's the one that is coming off by far her best finish in a major championship, a tie for third at the Ricoh Women's British Open. She likes and has some experience in team competition, being a member of Europe's Junior Solheim Cup team in 2013 and played also in the 2014 Curtis Cup for Great Britain and Ireland when she was an amateur. Last year, she turned pro at 18 and represented the Ladies European Tour in the Queen's Cup, which is a team event with Korean, Japanese, and Australasian LPGA tours. So she might be a rookie, but she's really, really good. And we got to see finally here in the U.S. a little bit of what she's all about there at the Ricoh Women's Open. Caroline Masson, the number 49 in the world, her third 2-3-2 from Germany. That's another one of those solid players and experienced players for her. Another of the rookies in the Solheim Cup and an LPGA rookie is Madeline Sackström from Sweden, 24 years old. She really broke all records at the Symetra Tour last year, and she's now 70 in the world. She's been adjusting now to a life in the PGA Tour, but definitely one very good player. She has a lot of tools she can pair with anybody. Mel Reid, 29 years old, but a rookie in the LPGA, 4-3-1 in her third Solheim Cup. Florentina Parker, another Solheim Cup rookie at 28 from England. She was number 2 in the ladies' European Tour rankings. And another one of the LPGA rookies that is also a Solheim rookie, Emily K. Peterson from Denmark, who's 21 years old. So, Fred, that team has a total record of 47-32-13. Their world rankings are not that big, so definitely on paper, the U.S. takes on them a lot more, but they have a lot of rookies who are very fiery and could bring it on to the U.S. team.
Yeah, I'll just go through the European team real quick here, Carlos. You covered most of it there. You know, Annika, as the captain, of course, one of the greatest winning players of all time, she has the ultimate respect of every player on the European team. 72 LPGA Tour titles, including 10 major championships. And since she's left competitive golf, she's raised 2 children and has built a golf business empire. So, you know, you were talking about the financial problems of the Ladies European Tour earlier in the show. And as a result of that, we have Georgia Hall and Florentina Parker, who finished 1 and 2 on the LET points list because there weren't any tournaments to play, basically, and all the good players are playing over here on the LPGA Tour. So I was worried about that, but I watched those two very closely the last couple of weeks in the Women's Scottish and again in the Ricoh Women's British Open. Georgia Hall is very impressive. I talked about her last week a little bit. She was very impressive and did a great job. I think she's going to be fun to watch, and she could be a real key in this thing. And also Parker, who's really kind of experienced. I didn't realize this, but she's 28. She turned pro back in 2009. She has 3 LET wins. She beat Segonda and Nordqvist just this year in the Mediterranean Ladies Open in April. So she's having a very good year, having a career year. And Annika really needs those two to play well for the European team to be competitive. She really needs them to do well. Mel Reid, this is her third appearance in Solheim Cup. Didn't realize that. Jody Ewart-Shadoff has played well here at coming in. So, and she pairs with Charlie Hall. They took down Paula Creamer and Lexi Thompson in 2013 in a match. So that could be very good. Both from England, so they get along well. This is Carlotta Segonda's third Solheim Cup appearance. She is Europe's highest-ranking automatic qualifier. Also, you mentioned Suzanne Pettersson. She just keeps chugging along. She, you know, she isn't winning, but she's still playing well, and she's right there. She has the experience. And then, I really think the key player for Annika's team is Charlie Hall. Can you believe this is Charlie's third Solheim Cup already? The first one she started was in 17 years old. Overall, she's 62, as you mentioned. She's very aggressive on the course. And if the Euros have a chance, I think Charlie really has to have a big week. I look for that. And that's one of the keys, I think. Karina Shea, she's very good with the 4-ball. She's a steady player. So you'll see her there. Probably won't see her in the foursomes. The captain's picks, Nordqvist, that was a no-brainer. Had to bring her in. If she's healthy, she had to play. Carolyn Masson was a little bit, she was on the bubble there, so we understand that. The two that we were kind of a little bit surprised, mildly surprised, was Emily Christine Pettersson and Madeline Sagstrom, both of them very young women. I think Annika is looking to the future here, and she sees very talented women here for future European Tour events and for their own careers and wants to kind of give them a leg up. So they will probably be used sparingly in the match play and the team events, but probably be paired with a very strong veteran, I'm guessing. So that's my take on the European team, Carlos.
How about the Americans? I mean, I'm going to go over them quickly, and I'll let you take the lead on that one. Lexi Thompson, 23 years old, third already. Solheim Cup as well, 3-2-2. Christy Kerr, 39 years old, in her 9th Solheim Cup. She has a 15-14-5 record. Stacey Lewis, 32 years old, 4th Solheim Cup, 4-7-1, surprisingly for her, not a winning record. Danielle Kang, who comes from winning a major championship, 24 years old. She's a Solheim rookie. Jarina Piller, the fiery Jarina Piller, 32 years old, third Solheim Cup, 3-2-2 record. Michelle Wee, 27 years old, fifth Solheim Cup, 7-7-1. Brittany Lang, 31 years old, fifth Solheim Cup, 5-6-3. Also, Brittany Lincecum, 31 years old in her sixth, and she really doesn't have a very good record here, 5-11-2. Lisette Salas, 28 years old, third Solheim Cup, 1-3-2. And the two rookies who were the picks, Angel Jin, 18 years old, Solheim Cup and LPGA rookie. Austin Ernest, 25 years old, Solheim rookie también, also. But Paula Creamer had to be, was the alternate, and she entered to substitute Jessica Korda, who had to retire because of an elbow injury. She has played in six Solheim Cups. The U.S. has won four of these. She's definitely one of those stalwarts that picks her game up when she plays here. It's a 14-8-5 record only, but she hasn't been playing that good at all. In right now, she's a 108th ranked player in the world. So what are your thoughts on the U.S. team?
Yeah, well, I'll start with Julie Inkster. You know, this is her second go-round as the Solheim Cup captain. Of course, she was the winning captain last 2 years ago in Germany. She's been there, she's done that, and she's done it well. She has 31 LPGA Tour wins, including seven major titles. Oh, yeah, she was the winning captain, as I mentioned, at the last Solheim Cup. This may be one of her more difficult coaching jobs, however. She's got Daniel Kang, Angel Jin, and Austin Ernst, three rookies on the team. We're seeing kind of a changing of the guard here with the Solheim, the U.S. Solheim Cup team. So coming down from the top, Lexi Thompson, by far the best player on the team. I would pair her with Stacy in every match and let them alone. I wouldn't even bother them. Just, okay, you guys go and play. Christy Kerr, experienced, calm, competitive, can be a steady player. You know, you pair her maybe with Michelle, maybe. I don't know. I mentioned Stacy Lewis. She's consistent. She's experienced. And did I mention she's consistent? She's the perfect four-ball and foursome player. You'd pair her with anybody, but preferably a long hitter, a real aggressive player. So then you've got Daniel Kang, who's kind of new to the team match scene. Her win this year at the Women's PGA was big for her. It has raised expectations. I'm telling you, I stood beside her on the tee when she was here at the Marathon Class a couple years ago, and I'm telling you, she's a little bit of nothing, okay? But she hits the ball a ton. She's a very good player. She won the 2010 U.S. Women's Amateur, so she knows a little bit about match play. Jarina Piller, consistent player, one of those that can be paired with a bomber for the four ball, or would be a great foursome partner for anybody. Michelle Wee, she's really been playing at a very high level over the past few months. I mean, she looks like hell playing, and injuries have been her problem and forced her withdrawal a couple of times. But when she's on, she is very, very good, maybe the best. So if Michelle's on and earning some points, that would be very good for the U.S. team. Brittany Lang still riding her U.S. Women's Open win from a year ago. She's playing at a high level, nothing fancy. She's a steady player. Brittany Lincecum, she's one of those bombers we talk about. Would play her in the four ball and sit her in the foursomes. I wouldn't let her near the foursome matches to go take a nap, do something. Lizette Salas, been somewhat inconsistent, but is a very good player and normally pretty consistent and probably will be playing foursomes. I don't know about four ball, but she'll probably be playing foursomes for sure. She might be one of those people you put with Angel Yin, maybe in a four-ball situation. Not sure about that. I did a little research on Yin. We don't know much about her except that she's a long hitter. She won the 7-8-year-old Junior World Golf Championships, won the California State Women's Amateur as a 12-year-old, and again as a 14-year-old, was the youngest player at the 2011 U.S. Women's Amateur, and was co-medalist at the U.S. Women's Amateur, and was the youngest player in the field in the 2012 Women's U.S. Open. I'm not sure how she plans to use Angel, but I'm guessing she's going to be with some kind of seasoned veteran and in a four ball and probably not play in the foursomes. Austin Ernst, she was the one that we were pretty surprised that Julie picked her. We're not sure why. She is inexperienced. So with her and Angel Yin and Daniel Kang, you've got three rookies on the team, which make it a little bit different for the U.S. All-in Cup team. And then, of course, as you mentioned, Paula Kramer is in as the alternate, replacing Jessica Korda. We all know about Paula. She loves match play. And I got to tell you, Carlos, I really look for Paula Kramer to have a very good week because she's been improving over the last 6 weeks. She's been trying to get on this team, and she's been playing and practicing hard. I look for her to do pretty well this week, actually. I think she's going to be a factor for Julie Inkster's team.
I really wanted her to be in that team. I didn't think – I'm sorry, but I don't get the Austin Ernst pick. It's nothing against her, but in here, I don't get it. We spoke last week about Angel Yin. I mentioned all those accolades for her, which is why I think I get where she got Angel Yin for. And basically, she's like, I remember mentioning that she reminds me a lot of Charlie Hall when she was 17 and was picked to play in the Solheim Cup. I mean, she is fiery. She has no fear. She's long. She's definitely a lot, reminds me a lot of Charlie Hall. I wouldn't be surprised that she goes out and do good. Now, I have another pairing for you that you didn't mention, but I assure you, that Daniel Kang, you said that you don't know how they're going to use her. You know, she is just a ball of fire. And she, I don't know if you saw posting her in Instagram, she is definitely ready, more than ready. She had her onesies, her red, white, and blue onesie over the weekend during a practice session and show that she's all in for the biennial tournament. I mean, she had the U.S. flag in a onesie, and definitely she is going to be fearless. And you know what? I see her playing along with her, who calls her the little sis, and that's Michelle Wee. If you don't know, they're more than just friends.
Yeah, you're right.
They're practically sisters. I assure you they're going to be playing together. There's no better chemistry between those in that team than those two there. And Paula Kramer, she has something to prove why she was taken out. I mean, she wasn't picked in the beginning. She was making the push. She's definitely ready for this. I mean, I see Lexi, Stacy, Jarena, Christy Kerr. I mean, Danielle is fearless. Michelle, we know she loves this here. And Paula Kramer, I mean, the U.S. is really loaded there, on paper at least. But our picks, do you see happening this weekend on the Solheim Cup?
Well, Carlos, every time there's a Solheim Cup competition, we talk about it, we look at it, we break it down, you look at the numbers, you look who's on, the rookies, the whatever, okay, who's been in a big competition, who's won majors. It always stacks up for the U.S. side. You know, I cannot see how the Europeans can win more than 6 points. But they have been very successful, especially over the past three Solheim Cups. They won two of them and forced the U.S. team to have a record comeback in singles to eke out a win in Germany in 2015. So that being said, I expect the U.S. team to win. But even with four rookies on the European team, I expect them to overachieve and give the U.S. team all at once. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I can't wait till the first ball gets up in the air on Friday.
You know, predicting this one is always very difficult. This year, Europe will have a revenge as a motive, but Team USA will have the home field advantage. I mean, and people there in Iowa, they know how to root for their sports. I think the U.S. Appears stronger and has more depth. But the players on Team Europe this year, if you see their record on their previous matches, it's a 59.5% of wins compared to just 48.7% for Team USA. So they definitely know how to play this. They are successful. They have been successful when they play the Solheim Cup. I look for the U.S. team to hold their own over the first 2 days in couples play where they always struggle for some reason, but they will have the edge on Sunday. I think it won't be as close as 1 point, but I see them winning like a 15-13, and I think you're going to see a lot of new stars coming out from the Europe side, like Georgia Hall. I think that we're going to see – I definitely see Madeline Sackstrom playing good there. I think she has a great future. Florentina Parker plays great. So I don't think they're going to back down. They have that challenge, but I still see Team USA winning. And I think also Angel Jin is going to show up and Daniel Kang. I think those are going to be two players that I want to see that I think are going to do great. On Europe, I want to see the play of Georgia Hall and Madeline Sackstrom. And on the U.S., I want to see Daniel Kang and Angel Jin. I am sure they're going to be playing very good. Anything left to say before we do our final parts?
No, I think we covered it well, Carlos. Should be a lot of fun. To your point, I think the lower-ranked players on the U.S. team are much better than the lower-ranked players on the European team. So during the singles play, I think that will show up. So when you got 12 matches in singles, U.S. will probably win more of those, maybe 7-5 or 8-4, something like that. So if they're close after the match play, after the team competition on Friday and Saturday, I think the U.S. Runs away with the singles.
We'll see that, and definitely that's the tournament to watch this weekend. Our final pods, last week we talked about Steph Curry shooting a pair of 74s on the Web.com Tour. This week I'll talk about the former Major League All-Star pitcher, Chigetochi Hasegawa, who will play in the 117th U.S. Amateur Golf Championship, generally regarded as the most prestigious amateur golf tournament in the world. More than 7,000 golfers tried to qualify for a spot in the field of 312. Hasegawa made it by shooting 2 under par for 2 rounds at his home course, Mission Viejo Country Club, on July 24th. So it has become, more than anything, a young man's championship for many, the final step to a professional career. The average of the age of the field is barely 22, and no one over the age of 24 has won the event since 1993. And why I mention this? Because Hasegawa is 49, but hey, he looks as fit as he did in his playing days and maintains that same lighthearted demeanor that made him so popular with teammates and fans, and he's hopeful that he can make at least a match play field of 64. And once there, he says, I figure anything can happen. One thing you can expect from him at 5 feet 11 and 170 pounds is that he, that guy that went at guys like Barry Bonds, Albert Bell, and Frank Thomas without ever backing down, he won't back down from this challenge. And final putt, a rare beef, Andrew Johnson will turn his back in America. He's going to go back to Europe to see if he can make it into the top 10. He admitted his struggles this year in the PGA Tour, and he will try to climb back into the top 50. He says it's impossible to play on both tours unless you're in the top 50. And you know what, Fred? He's right. He's a distant right now, 185 in the FedEx Cup rankings. And he's sharing a house here in Charlotte with Tyrell Hatton, so I guess we'll see a Craigslist post for a new roommate soon.
Yeah, Carlos, just a couple things real quick. The RNA is conducting the Junior Amateur Championships. While the U.S. Boys and Girls Junior Amateurs just wrapped up a couple weeks ago, juniors from Europe and the rest of the world are fired up to begin the RNA's Junior Championships in Nairn and Nairn Dunbar this week. 28 countries are represented in the boys' tournament, won last year by Germany's Falko Hennisch, who is in the field again this year to defend his title. Junior golfers have traveled from Australia, Hong Kong, India, New Zealand, and the United States to compete for the amateur titles this week. There are 144 young women in the girls' side of the competition. Emily Palatinari won last year. She's also on the field again this year. Just like the U.S. Junior Amateurs, competitors will compete in two rounds of stroke play to determine the 64 top seeds, who will then vie for the championship title in match play for the balance of the week. Carlos, I don't know if you've seen this or not, but there's a video about Traden Karch. That's T-R-A-D-E-N Karch, K-A-R-C-H. Rory McIlroy narrated it. He has befriended this young boy who suffered a severe head injury in a terrible car accident and has had to learn to talk, walk all over again. He lost all memory from before the accident. The video is quite moving. He had to regain the use of his limbs and learn how to once again swing a golf club, which he played golf at a pretty decent level prior to the accident. He won junior tournaments and was playing pretty well. So this video is very moving. I suggest everyone look it up. Again, we talked about the Kyle Miller thing, overcoming cerebral palsy to play in a professional golf tournament. Here's a young man that is, they expected him to die during the night when he was in the hospital. His skull was shattered into so many small pieces that they just didn't see any way that he was going to be able to live. And he's come back and is playing golf again, and it's quite moving. If you just Google Traden Karch, T-R-A-D-E-N-K-A-R-C-H, and Rory McIlroy video, I'm sure it will come up, and you can view that, Carlos.
Well, Back Niners, that wraps up another week of the Back Nine Report. Thank you for listening. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest in the world of golf. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Blog Talk Radio. Or if you missed it, check it out on iTunes or tune in. Also, you know you can see us on Roku TV. And if you haven't done so, follow the show on Twitter. Our ID is at Back Nine Report. Don't forget, this weekend is Solheim Cup weekend, so you can't miss it. And I just want to see that BFF handshake between Michel Wee and Daniel Kang. I long for seeing it. It's the best ever. My name is Carlos Torres. Along with Fred Alvader, we wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
It's Mom's Zone. Breaking news, the Fremont family declares where they're going for back to school.
The Fremonts are going with Academy.
Mrs. Fremont, why Academy over another store?
When my kids say they'll never use math in the real world, I just show them how low my Academy receipt is.
Do you have any other thoughts?
Look, back to school is a numbers game, and numbers don't lie.
Nobody starts your season with better brands and lower prices than Academy. Academy Sports and Outdoors. For all, for less. Price match guarantee details at academy.com.
It's Mom's Zone. Breaking news, the Fremont family declares where they're going for back to school.
The Fremonts are going with Academy.
Mrs. Fremont, why Academy over another store?
When my kids say they'll never use math in the real world, I just show them how low my Academy receipt is.
Do you have any other thoughts?
Look, back to school is a numbers game, and numbers don't lie.
Nobody starts your season with better brands and lower prices than Academy. Academy Sports and Outdoors. For all, for less. Price match guarantee details at academy.com.